Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court.
Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to this special session of the court in Norfolk. Very nice to have everyone here today, and we certainly appreciate the fact that Admiral Lottie is hosting us here today. Now, before we proceed with the oral argument, we are going to have a bar admission ceremony. So at this time, the court recognizes Commander Beasley Ledet for a motion.
Good morning. May it please the court. I move admission of Emily DeLees, State Bar of North Carolina, Kristen Highsmith, State Bar of Illinois, Mashonda Mosley, State Bar of Maryland, Thomas Sue, State Bar of Nebraska, Meredith A. Wells, State Bar of Nebraska, and Ashley Young, District of Columbia. I have examined their credentials on file in the office of the court, and I am satisfied that they possess the qualifications for membership in the bar of the court.
Thank you, Commander Beasley Ledet. Counsel, my colleagues and I have conferred, and we are convinced of your integrity and of your legal acumen. Accordingly, we have voted unanimously to admit you to the bar of this court. Therefore, Commander Beasley Ledet, your motion is granted. Mr. Squires, please administer the oath.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that you will support the Constitution of the United States and that you will conduct yourself as attorneys and counsels of this court uprightly and according to law, so help you God?
I do.
Counsel, I'd like to welcome you to the bar of the court. In doing so, I believe it's appropriate for me to recite the words that are engraved at the University of Virginia School of Law, which both Judge Johnson and I attended. Those aspirational words are as follows: that those alone may be servants of the law who labor with learning, courage, and devotion to preserve liberty and promote justice. Because all of you exemplify those ideals, it is a pleasure indeed to admit you to the bar of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Congratulations. You may be seated. Mr. Squires, do you have any other business before the court before you proceed to oral argument?
Your Honor, we do not.
Very well, then. We will now hear the case of United States versus Davis. Because the Army TJAG filed a certificate for review in this case, the government is the appellant and will argue first. Captain Miller. Are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Major Oshag, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellee?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Please proceed.
Yes, Your Honor.
And, Your Honor, with leave of the court, the government would request to split our time 18 and 2.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Stuart Miller, and I, along with my co-counsel, Colonel Richard Guarini, represent the United States, the appellant, in the case before the court today. The two certified issues in this case are closely related, and the record of this case and analysis of the relevant case law support two findings in response to those certified issues. First, the judicial reassignment of the appellee's case did not result in error, structural or otherwise. And second, assuming for argument's sake that it did, dismissal with prejudice was an inappropriately severe remedy. In response to that first certified issue, there are three distinct areas that warrant discussion. rule for court-martial 505, rule for court-martial 902, and structural error. Beginning with rule for court-martial 505, which states...
Captain Miller, before you get into the specifics of the rules, I'd like to pose to you a broad question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, is it the position of the United States government that a trial judge's interest in promoting judicial efficiency should take precedence over that judge's responsibility to protect the constitutional rights of an accused serviceman?
No, Your Honor.
Well, how do you square that with what happened in this case?
So, Your Honor, at the threshold, this Court has resolved that the accused or the appellee in this case did not have a constitutional right to a unanimous verdict. So as a threshold matter, that question as it pertains to this case has been answered. But when
Chief.
No, please proceed, Judge.
Captain Shumpert. Miller, at the time that the trial judge and the chief judge took his actions, this Court had not decided Anderson.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So in Judge Pritchard's affidavit, he reconciles his decision to remove himself from all cases and from not ruling further on motions for unanimous verdict, recognizing that so long as this issue was raised and preserved, regardless of how a trial judge ruled on it, the appellant would not be precluded from seeking relief should this Court have found differently with respect to that right for unanimous verdict. So
let's break that down into its component parts. Right now and in your brief, you seem to be saying that no matter how this played out, it'd be no harm, no foul in terms of the right of an accused service member to have a unanimous verdict. But is that really accurate? As Judge Johnson has just noted, we need to look at this through the eyes of what was going on at the time that the judge made the decision to take himself away from this case. And there's a dispute between you and Appellee in regard to what that action was, how that should be captured. But at that time, he believed that a service member had a constitutional right to a unanimous verdict. He did not know that this Court would rule that there is no such constitutional right. So let's say that he had been correct, and the accused in this case had gone to trial. There was not a unanimous verdict, but he was convicted. Your point in your briefs is that then, 6 months later, if our court had determined or the lower appellate court had determined that there was a right, that there'd be no harm, no foul, but he could have been incarcerated during that period. So how is it that the judge here, Judge Pritchard, was not in fact saying, I am going to give this case to another judge who may not protect the constitutional rights of the accused as I perceive them, and that's perfectly fine because my interest is in promoting judicial efficiency.
Your Honor, I would respond by noting that Judge Pritchard didn't orchestrate the denial of these motions through the reassignment of these cases, and in his affidavit, he makes clear that he doesn't know how other judges might rule on these motions for unanimous verdicts. So insofar as this right hypothetically would exist, I don't believe his actions in reassigning these cases to other judges, especially where he has two cases at the Army Court, has stayed on his docket. So however these other judges may have ruled, the simple fact is he has two cases that are sitting on his docket, not moving, pending the Army Court's reconciliation of the writ that was pending. And reassigning cases to the other judges, regardless of how they were going to rule, promoted judicial efficiency and didn't come at the cost of a procedure, actual constitutional right, Your Honor.
But he knew that in regard to unanimous verdict, how he would rule.
Yes,
you say he doesn't know how the judge he was assigning to it would rule, but he did know there was at least a chance, as in fact turned out here, that the other judge would say there is no constitutional right to unanimous verdict. So my point in my long soliloquy a moment ago is that wasn't it a situation where Judge Pritchard was saying, I am not going to protect your constitutional right. I'm going to pass this along to another judge and let that judge decide whether you have that right or not.
Well, Your Honor, in his role as a chief circuit judge, that was his job, was to detail cases as they came in through the Army's Fifth Judicial Circuit to the subordinate judges here, Judge Hines being the only other Army judge in that judicial circuit. So it would create a situation where either he was going to keep every case that came through the jurisdiction, or he was going to continue exercising his function as the chief circuit judge and detailing subordinate judges to cases as they came in.
But in his affidavit, he specifically spelled out why he was sending this case over to the other judge. It wasn't a situation where he said, I'm just sending cases as they come in because I'm overloaded. He specifically cited this constitutional issue, didn't he?
Yes, Your Honor. He talked about his reason for reassigning cases and for his basis to no longer sit on cases simultaneously. So he is continuing to detail other judges to cases. However, does acknowledge that he is not going to be taking additional cases at the time.
So why doesn't that circle back to my initial question to you? Is it the position of the government that a judge, a trial judge here, the chief judge of the circuit, has the authority to place precedence on judicial efficiency rather than protecting the constitutional rights of the accused servers? That seems to be what you're saying happened here. Initially you said no, but now you're saying that made sense for Judge Pritchard to send it because otherwise everything was going to be piling up on his docket if he continued to protect the constitutional rights of an accused servicemen.
Your Honor, that his detailing of these other judges, again, didn't come with the knowledge of how they were going to rule. There was nothing to indicate that his intent was for other judges to deny these motions and keep things moving towards trial. As he articulates in his affidavit, yes, he had ruled in favor of motions for unanimous verdicts in United States versus Dial and Faria, and as such, those cases had been stayed on his docket. So as such, that's why he was detailing these other cases. And in a case like this, where the motion for unanimous verdict had not even been filed at the time of judicial reassignment, that's an important distinction.
Well, you say it's an important distinction, but the filing deadline had not expired at the time that he, in fact, reassigned, or however you wish to caption it, to
the
lower judge.
Yes, but in looking at the Army Court's analysis of moving into Rule for Court-Martial 902 and the series of conclusions that they make in their analysis of this predetermined intent to deny this motion for unanimous verdict, that it was his desire, and that Colonel Hines knew of that and therefore had decided a material matter in Appellee's case prior to receiving it.
Counsel, can we speak about Judge Hines? The CCA found that Judge Hines was not impartial, and largely they looked at the first affidavit, not entirely clear that they looked at the second affidavit. What deference do we owe the Court of Criminal Appeals' determination that Judge Hines was not impartial?
None, Your Honor. You have the record before you, but you are reviewing that issue, I believe, de novo. And insofar as he failed to recuse himself when he otherwise should have, the abuse of discretion standard is the appropriate standard of review to that effect.
What is the authority for it being a de novo review?
Your Honor, it would be compliance with the rules for court-martial. So here, 902, and then this court's review for prejudice is de novo.
Counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
Speaking of recusal in 902, are there limitations on the reasons why a judge can recuse themselves under 902?
No, Your Honor, but the looking at Justice Kennedy's concurring opinion in Liddicke, he talks about how a judge should be disqualified only if it appears that he or she harbors an aversion, hostility, or disposition of a kind that a fair-minded person could not set aside when judging the dispute. The rule for court-martial further discusses that to be disqualifying under rule for court-martial 902 Bravo 1, the judge's bias must be based upon extrajudicial personal knowledge, not knowledge gained through performance of judicial duties.
And what authority does this court or CCA have to review? If a judge, if I look at most of our case law and even the rules, they seem to be written in a way such that we have judges who the parties ask to recuse themselves and who don't want to. But here we have a situation where a judge arguably recused himself, and maybe the parties didn't want him to. Does Does the CCA, do the appellate courts have any authority to review a judge's decision who has decided to recuse himself and tell that judge that that recusal was an error?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of case law that would be dispositive answering that question either which way. We certainly are aware of cases where a judge decides not to recuse himself and the standard of review for that sort of issue. But as this Court has done in previously looking at these matters, assuming for argument's sake Judge Pritchard was disqualified and that he should no longer have taken action in Appellee's case, the analysis shifts squarely to Colonel Hines in looking at the fairness of Appellant's trial. And a review of the record, when this Court does look at Judge Hines' performance on the record, it will see that on the eve of trial, Appellee sought to be tried by a judge alone, knowing that Judge Hines would likely be the military judge that presided over the case.
Can I just ask, and everyone here, counsel, when he's speaking? Okay. Please proceed.
That throughout the trial, Appellee doesn't cite a single instance to demonstrate on the record, on the merits portion of this case, that Judge Hines acted unfairly in any way. Judge Hines ultimately acquitted Appellant of one of the three specifications for which he was charged. Judge Hines imposed the exact sentence that Appellee asked for. So a review of the record, if we frame it solely in assuming for argument's sake Judge Pritchard did recuse himself and was disqualified from further participation, when you shift the analysis to Judge Hines, there's nothing in the record to support finding that he was anything but fair and impartial. Whether this Court looks finds error and looks under the constitutional or non-constitutional standards for prejudice, under either, there's an absence of any indication that Judge Hines was anything but a fair and impartial judge.
Counsel, I have another question. Judge Pritchard justified his actions by saying he was trying to support judicial efficiency. And conventional wisdom certainly says, I've told people before, that that is something in military justice that we're always, the military, it's an interest in the military to have an efficient and quick and certain military. But what can we point to other than conventional wisdom if we wanted to support that that was a valid government interest? Judge Pritchard had a valid interest in this concept of judicial efficiency in clearing his docket. Is there a DOD rule or an Army rule? Is it or a provision in the code that says that that is a valid consideration for him to take action on?
So, Your Honor, I believe the Ninth Circuit, in a case that we cite and that Appellee cited, in Cruz v. Abate, they looked at judicial efficiency as a reason for which that federal judge was detailing subordinate judges to cases within that jurisdiction. I'm unaware of a DOD rule in particular that would support this, again, other than what you've mentioned, Your Honor.
Counsel, on that same point, the Court of Criminal Appeals said that a chief circuit judge can detail military judges to hear cases for a variety of reasons, to give them experience, to allow a reservist to hear a case, but not for this reason. So my question is, what determines what is a proper reason for detailing a case and what doesn't it? It almost sounds like, from your brief, your position is that we cannot inquire into the reasons for the detailing because the judge doesn't have to provide the reasons for the detailing.
So to clarify the government's position, Your Honor, so under Rule for Court Martial 505, that rule is looking at timing. In United States versus Smith, the Court of Military Appeals opinion that discusses that, 505 is a timing rule, that the military judge can be detailed by a competent authority without good cause being shown on the record so long as that detailing occurs before the court has been assembled. So where a reassignment on its own wouldn't create these problems. It's when you have a secondary issue, like in this case, presented by the Army Court, where 902 is implicated by the reassignment. So reassignment on its own doesn't create some sort of basis. It's when it implicates something else, such as bias or the appearance thereof, that the problem arises, Your Honor. So it's not for any reason, but when it doesn't implicate 902 or some other disqualification basis, then the absence of good cause being shown on the record is not problematic, Your Honor. It's just the triggering of some other issue.
But Captain Miller, if we assume, let's assume that Chief Judge Pritchard was disqualified under 902 and his removal was effectively a recusal, then he no longer had authority to assign a subordinate judge under RCM 505. So how do you square those two?
So, Your Honor, I would square these. I believe it's this court's opinion in Butcher, where this court looked at a similar issue and said, assuming for argument's sake, this judge should have recused himself, we're going to shift our analysis to look at that second judge. So again, insofar as it's an administrative, you'd look at whether that bias or that taint was carried over from Judge Pritchard to Judge Hines, which the affidavits paint a very clear picture of the fact that it was not. The Army Court found structural error, and as the Supreme Court noted in John...
Let me ask you a question. Why shouldn't we share the CCA's concern that the second affidavit of Judge Hines had an adversarial tone to it? He referred to the fact that the appellate counsel was, quote, unfairly twisting his words to suggest a nefarious motive on his part and of making baseless accusations against him in the course of client advocacy. He's speaking here of essentially defense attorneys, although at the appellate level. And here we've got a situation where Appellee is saying this second affidavit only served to further erode public confidence in the judicial process. How do you respond to that?
So, Your Honor, I would respond by highlighting that at the time Judge Hines is providing his first affidavit, there have been no filings with the CCA. So he's responding to a very limited understanding of the context of why he's being asked what he can recall about his detailing to the case a year after the fact. At the time of the second affidavit, Appellee has filed their brief to the CCA wherein they allege that Judge Hines acted as Judge Pritchard's surrogate or proxy and that he had a predetermined intent to deny Appellee's motion for unanimous verdict to further Judge Pritchard's desire to expedite the trial process. So at the time of the second affidavit, the landscape is much clearer in what Judge Hines is responding to, what the allegations are, the flaws in the trial process. So a very small portion of his affidavit is responding to that, to what is in essence an allegation that he abandoned his impartiality for the sake of judicial efficiency and that resulted in deprivation of Appellee's rights, most notably to an impartial and fair judge. So at the time, it's the context that ultimately matters, and that is such a small portion of that second affidavit. So this court should recognize that, both the context and the contents. And I see that my time has expired. Pending any additional questions from this court should set aside the Army Court's opinion and affirm the findings and sentence of the trial court.
Any further questions from the bench? Nothing. Thank you, Captain Miller.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Osay.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. The moment Judge Pritchard reassigned this case so that defense's unanimous verdict motion could be denied, due process was violated, and there were ample grounds for disqualification for Judge Pritchard. Judge Hines is also disqualified. For one, he knows what Judge Pritchard is doing, and he's going along with it. For the same reason that Judge Pritchard is disqualified, so is Judge Hines. And separately, one would question, reasonably so, whether or not Judge Hines could keep an open mind under these circumstances when he received that motion just a few hours later. And coloring all of this, which wasn't discussed in the government's presentation, was none of this was disclosed. It was required to be disclosed, and in fact, Judge Pritchard refused to disclose his reasons. Now, I'd like to touch first on a couple of things that the government has said. They claim that Judge Pritchard was not trying to orchestrate a certain ruling and that he did not really know what was going to happen. I would say two things to that. First being, why is he doing what he's doing if he's not trying to orchestrate or at least create the opportunity, the chance, for that motion to come out the other way?
Why would we not just answer that question just what he said? He said, I am a practical roadblock to all of these cases moving forward. And every case I rule in, then the government's going to appeal to the CCA. We've already seen the CCA's cards. They're going to overrule me. And we're going to be back where we are. Just exactly what he said. In the interest of judicial efficiency, I'm just going to pull myself out of the process. Why wouldn't we just accept what he said in his affidavit?
Your Honor, judicial efficiency can be considered in certain rulings, but the Constitution recognizes higher values than efficiency. And from the circumstances of this case, it's clear that Judge Pritchard, in fact, understands that, because if he believed those were adequate grounds, why does he need another judge to do that? Why wouldn't he just take the bench and rule and say, regardless of the merits, there's judicial economy and efficiency, and so I'm going to deny the motion? If he believed that those were legitimate grounds, he would just do that. But instead, he needs to go find another judge to do it for him.
But he's already been overruled twice at this point, right? Like, there's sort of an inevitability to everything that's going on here. He can just keep ruling. He can keep getting overturned. The trial gets delayed 6 months, however long it takes the CCA process to run out.
Your Honor, he hasn't been overturned at this point. There's been two cases that are pending.
I thought when this case was handed off, the government had already sought and obtained their the CCA didn't call it a writ of prohibition, but that had already happened.
They had sought the writ. So I believe in January, Dial and Feretta both happened.
Right.
So those writs, Your Honor, weren't disposed of until June, and all this is now happening in April. So whatever the merits were, when all of this is being decided, is still up in the air. He has not been overruled by the Army Court at this point. That does not come until months later. In fact, after appellees' trial.
But had they not stayed his ruling? His initial granting of the motion, they had stayed.
Those cases were stayed. Yes,
right.
Your Honor.
So those cases are on ice, right? While the CCA figures out what to do with them. So he knows what's going to happen. Every time he rules on one of these motions and grants it, the case is going to get put on ice, right? So he knows that. That's certain. So is it just that his concern over that and all these cases grinding to a halt isn't a valid justification for doing what he's doing, or is this that it doesn't, it's outweighed by the appellee's interests?
Either way, Your Honor, I think we come to the same conclusion, in that those interests cannot be, at the end of the day, carry the day for him to do what he did.
Let's just assume, because I think this is your point, that he's recusing himself effectively. That's your preferred interpretation of his actions. Is that right?
I would say there are clear grounds for his disqualification, Your Honor. The Army Court went with that he's recusing himself. I don't think we necessarily went that route in the briefs, although I don't see that as an unreasonable application of the law.
Well, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth. So did anyone move for his disqualification?
No, Your Honor. But there was no disclosure. And as we can see from the appellant's affidavit, there would have been grounds, and he would have sought recusal had he known what was going on.
Okay. Well, if we treat it then as a 902 recusal, I'll pose to you the same question that I posed to the government, which was, does the CCA or this court or any appellate court have any authority to review that action and determine that his recusal was an error? Or do we just have to accept his recusal for whatever grounds it was on as something that can't be undone?
I would think it could be reviewed, Your Honor, but I'm not saying that it's necessarily he is recusing himself so much as he is reassigning the case for a improper reason.
Well, he does that after he removes himself from the case. We'll call it a recusal for simplicity's sake. Then maybe he commits an error by reassigning the case at that point, because I think our case law is pretty clear that he shouldn't have anything to do with the case. Where is the concern here? Is there concern that he recused himself? Is that the error? Or is the concern, your concern, that he reassigned the case after he recused himself? Or is it both?
The concern is that he is fixing the outcome of a motion in appellee's case, and that is a due process violation, Your Honor. And those are grounds, those give rise to grounds for disqualification.
Go ahead.
Well, you've sort of moved on
to another issue then, is that regardless of what he did in the recusal or whatever we want to call it, in the reassignment, if predetermining the outcome. Is he really predetermining the outcome? Because he says he's not, and Judge Hines says he's not. I know the CCA thought differently, but is he really doing that, or is he just removing the certain possibility or near certain possibility that if he had received the motion, he would have granted it? Is he taking it, is he just moving it from a certain grant to we don't know what will happen, or is it your position that he's moving it from a certain grant to a certain deny?
Are you in terms of Judge Hines, Your Honor?
By moving the case,
or
by
Judge
taking
Pritchard.
Himself off the case and transferring it to Judge Hines, or anyone else, really. That
he is intending to create at least the opportunity that this motion, which he believes the accused is entitled to, is denied.
And is that enough? Because the CCA seemed to think that he was moving it from a certain grant to a certain deny. But your position is, you don't need to accept the CCA's position. He's just moving it from a certain grant, if he had heard the motion, to maybe a grant, but maybe a deny with Judge Hines.
If his intent is to create the opportunity that it would be denied, that is enough. However, I would think the record shows that his intent is more than that. In JA 2024, he's showing up in the Coley case at the PX, telling that judge, because this happened in multiple cases, not just a police case, but multiple cases. He's telling that judge, you will deny this motion and move on. And I'm not suggesting.
Can I ask about the Coley case? In Coley, it seems like the argument, or one of the arguments, was that it was unlawful command influence. Isn't that a more apt framework for looking at what Judge Pritchard did in both cases? Why are we not discussing unlawful command influence? Why would a due process issue some sort of vague, more vague thing when no member subject to code can attempt to influence the outcome of a court-martial?
I certainly think that's possible, Your Honor. That was raised in Coley. It was raised in Grostefan, the supplemental Grostefan as well in this case. We think if this court finds it a better route,
Well, we don't usually find a due process violation when there is a statutory means of addressing a particular issue. It's like you don't get a claim that you have due process because you couldn't call a witness. It's a claim that you violated the rule allowing you to call a witness. And I think it makes a difference because the standard for finding prejudice for unlawful command influence is different from potentially the standard for finding prejudice with a due process violation.
Yes, Your Honor, I don't disagree. This court could come out in either way on that. Again, we have raised that in a supplemental Grostefan.
Can I switch questions also while I have the microphone, because I know it's hard to get it. Do you agree with the government that we review de novo the CCA's determination that Judge Hines was not impartial?
For errors, Your Honor, this court typically determined whether or not there was an error. This court typically pierces through the lower court and looks at the record of trial.
And if we do that, can we look at the second affidavit?
The second affidavit if you're looking at the second affidavit, Your Honor, you're looking at that not in terms of error. You're looking at that in terms of how that plays into the Lilleberg analysis, which is de novo. And under the third prong, you consider everything that happens from the trial until this moment in time. So, yes, you would consider that second affidavit, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Major Al-Sahi, may I ask you a question then? Did the accused receive a fair trial in front of Judge Hines?
I think any time judges are complicit in fixing rulings to come out in certain ways.
That's
no, Your Honor, that is not
a loaded term to level at a judge, that he was complicit in doing this. What can you point to in the affidavits or anything else in the record that shows he was quote unquote complicit?
Well, he knows certainly what he reveals a conversation between Judge Hines reveals a conversation between himself and Judge Pritchard, in which Judge Pritchard disclosed his issue and what he was doing. And at that point, Judge Hines agrees to take the case.
Judge Hines says, essentially, I don't recall the exact words, but it's pretty close to, I'm willing to do my part for the circuit in terms of adjudicating cases.
Well,
to
clarify, Your Honor, he says, I agreed to take the case to do my part to mitigate against the backlog posed by Dial. It was specifically related to unanimous verdicts.
Did he specifically cite Dial?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So then, to go back to my original question, is there anything you can point to that would show, once we get past your concern, that there was anything other than a fair trial for this accused? We've got a situation where Judge Hines, I'm telling unless the United States Supreme Court rules to the contrary, Judge Hines was correct. There is no constitutional right to a unanimous verdict by a panel. You've got Judge Hines acquitting the accused of one of the two charges, and then Judge Hines imposing the exact sentence that was asked for by the defense, which is unusual, not unheard of, but unusual. Is there anything you can point to in the record that shows that the accused received an unfair trial?
There's a question on the expert assistance motion, Your Honor, which the Army Court did not decide. So in that case, and that was also raised.
But the mere ruling by a military judge against an accused on a motion isn't a sufficient basis to say that there was lack of a fair trial.
Well, if he was deprived of his right to expert assistance, Your Honor, I think the implication would be he did not receive a fair trial.
But that's not before us.
It is in the sense of you can factor that in into the Lilleberg analysis when it comes to the risk of injustice.
So how do we get to the Lilleberg analysis? Now, there obviously was a constitutional issue at play here, but as we stand here today, there was in fact no constitutional issue. So why are we not imposing our more traditional standard of review when determining whether there was prejudice here?
Because Lilleberg, Your Honor, concerns the process, not the outcomes. Just in an extreme example, just to illustrate the point, if this was a bribery case over unanimous verdicts, I don't think we would say, but there's no right to unanimous verdict. We would be concerned by how the court got to that point, the process by which justice was administered, not necessarily the outcome. And I think when you look at all of the factors here, they weigh heavily in our favor. First, this was a clear error. As Lilleberg would say, it was both not insubstantial nor excusable.
When you say, what is the clear error that you're referring to? Because there's all kinds of errors floating around, potential errors. What would you put your finger on as the one clear error that we would look at?
Well, you go back to the original sin, Your Honor, of Judge Pritchard deciding that even though he believes this accused is entitled to a constitutional right, he's going to take action and
so,
allow
so
for that not to
the
happen.
The recusal? Because if it's the recusal, if it's removing him from the case, then your answer to my earlier question about can we review his decision to recuse himself is yes, we can, and we can find that it was an error. Because if it was the recusal off the case, then that's the error that you're depending on. Now, if it's the reassignment of the case after he recused himself to someone else, then that's potentially a different kind of error. Which error? Is it the whole situation?
It's the whole situation, Your Honor.
Does that include our ability to tell him that his error was in recusal? That he? What if he had done it under 505, put his reasons on the record, then we'd be reviewing for good cause, whether he had good cause?
Well, I think the government is slightly mistaken about 505. 505 simply says you don't need good cause until after the court is assembled. But that is not to say that it can be for any cause. In fact, the Smith case that both of us cite says this can't be for an improper reason. And in fact, if it was for an improper reason, it would, quote, require severe remedial action. So you can't just, before the court is assembled, play judicial musical chairs all you want, especially if it's to try and put your thumb on the scale for a motion to come out a particular way of which you believe the accused has a constitutional right. I'm just trying to think of the second and third order effects of this, Your Honor. Are we to say that a judge who has a motion for expert assistance can say, I believe you have a constitutional right to expert assistance, but you know what, I'm concerned about contracting, how long it's going to take to contract. It might take a couple of months. So without telling the accused, I'm just going to go find another judge who may deny that expert assistance. And it's okay, because we'll just say judicial efficiency. I would think that is clearly unacceptable.
So then do we also say that if, say, a judge does disclose, they need to put, they have a duty, or say they recuse themselves, they have a duty to put all their reasons on the record?
Well, in this particular case, Your Honor, when it comes to...
Well, we got to tell judges what they have to do going forward.
I would say RCM 813 tells judges what they do, which is any time a judge is replaced, the military judge shall place the reasons on the record.
And I'm going to jump in before time runs out, because my question ties back into that. In responding to Chief Judge Olson's question about receiving a fair trial, and you cited to the expert assistance, I believe in the briefs or in the affidavit, there also was an assertion that when the accused made his forum selection and selected Judge Alone, because Judge Pritchett had refused to put his statement in, that then the accused was making a decision in the blind.
That is correct, Your
Honor.
So
is that still your position?
That is still one of the, okay. Ma'am. Yes, Your Honor.
I have a practical question that may be unfair to you to ask, and if you don't know the answer, I'll ask the government. What would have happened if Judge Pritchard, after he removed himself or recused himself from the case, recognizing our case law, just declined to do anything with it going forward? So it sits there for a while. Like what? Then what?
The error would still be potentially there, although that would be a much harder hill for us to climb, quite honestly, Your Honor. I think it's you really need both. If he's going to, I mean, he has, quite frankly, a duty to sit, and the fact that he's dodging motions, even if they just sit there, I think brings.
Well, let's say he had recused himself for a valid reason, and so he recused himself, but it's his responsibility as the chief judge of the district to do something with the case, but he can't touch it anymore. That's what our case law says. So what happens to the case, just practically speaking?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, but I would believe that the chief of the trial judiciary is the detailing authority, but I don't have
is the answer at some point, you know, someone up the chain of command would have noticed that we've got a case just in limbo, lingering, and they would have done something with it. Is that the answer?
I think he would tell the chief of the trial judiciary that he's been recused, and someone else other than him needs to take action on the case.
And if that person had assigned it to Judge Hines, would there be a problem?
Yes, Your Honor, but again, it would be a much harder...
I'm curious, what would the problem be?
Because he is taking himself off the case because he does
okay,
not...
So the assignment to Judge Hines, that part of it wouldn't then be a problem. The only part of the problem would be that Judge Pritchard recused himself or removed himself from the case.
There would still be, I mean, why is he coming off the case and someone coming on the case? It's because he doesn't want to rule and he wants something else to happen. Whether he's detailing Judge Hines, someone else is detailing Judge Hines, I think it's...
So we have to look in, again, the reviewing courts have to look into his motives, why he removed himself from the case. Right. So I'm just worried that we're setting up this paradigm where a judge recuses. We don't know why. He doesn't say why. He just recuses from a case. And then maybe it's for very personal reasons, right? Maybe he has an illicit affair with somebody on one of the trial teams that he doesn't want to disclose. He doesn't want to, you know, or who knows? Maybe it's a medical reason. It could be any number of personal reasons that he doesn't want to get into. Are we setting up a regime where he has a duty to disclose, he has a duty to be questioned about it, we have the right as appellate courts to then review his motives and decide whether he had proper or improper motives in recusing from the case and whether or not those motives perhaps infringe on the due process rights of the accused? Like, is that whole system, is that what we're envisioning?
No, Your Honor. I don't, and I see I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Please proceed and respond to Judge Hardy's question.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't think we're going down a road in which judges with legitimate recusal decisions to take themselves off the case are going to receive court orders to delve into what they were doing. I think part of the piece here is that 813 required those reasons to be put on the record. What was the reassignment about? And that reassignment was about Judge Pritchard wants to rule favorably for you, but he doesn't want that to happen. That's what they would have to say.
Any further questions from the bench? Judge Johnson?
Yes, Chief, I interrupted him as he was going through his Lilsberg analysis, and so if it's okay with you,
yes.
Can we let him finish? Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor. So there's a host of factors you have, the clear air, the fact that it happened with multiple judges, right? You have this clear air that neither Judge Pritchard can see is air, Judge Hines can't really see it as air. They went to the chief of the trial judiciary who did not stop this. So we just have this several judges not actually seeing how much of a problem this is, which I think is a big hit on the confidence in our judiciary. And in fact, she said, and it's in the joint appendix, Your Honor, that he was right not to say anything. You have this happening in multiple cases. You have the impact that's happened on the
Can
forum.
Can you keep
selection.
Your answer more tailored to the question by Judge Johnson about the Lilsberg factors
yeah.
and be succinct?
Oh yes. Excuse me, Your Honor.
Well,
just
no, I think
the third
I got
factor.
It. You
I'm
just did two and three.
The,
so,
all
which,
the reasons
which
of
leads me to my next question, which was then, is that why the your position is that the appropriate remedy is dismissal with prejudice? Because you've just laid out the widespread impact, so factor two in Lilsberg, that this could impact other cases, and then three, the perception issue, that concern. So is that the basis for your argument why the CCA's ruling is correct, that this should be dismissed with prejudice?
Well, Your Honor, I have a couple points to that, Your
okay.
Honor, actually.
Well, I've got the, you extra time, first, but and you need to be succinct,
the chief said.
Okay.
The first being, I think, Lilsberg gets us to reversal. I think the Army Court, it was really that second affidavit that warranted the, at least according to the CCA, the dismissal with prejudice, and that is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. This court said in Atchak, which I'm happy to supplementally cite, that is for the discretion whether or not to authorize a rehearing. And that is a separate question than the prejudice. And I would end with this, that the way the second certified issue is actually written, it's all about whether or not prejudice, not necessarily dismissal with prejudice. It's was the Army Court wrong to find prejudice, thereby dismissing with prejudice? So if you get to the conclusion that this case warranted reversal under Lilsberg, then the second certified issue doesn't really get at whether or not it's still appropriate to dismiss with prejudice.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions?
No.
Seeing none, thank you, Major Ostege.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Captain Campbell, you reserve time.
Chief Judge Olson, to briefly go back to your question that you posed to government about our position on a perceived constitutional right versus judicial efficiency. And in this case, another factor that this court should look at and is acknowledged through Judge Pritchard's affidavit is the unsettled nature of this perceived right, that after ruling in favor of it in Dial and Faria, the Army Court had stayed the docket, and it was pending at that time. So insofar as judicial efficiency came at the cost of a perceived constitutional right, there's that added layer of the fact that this is now entirely unsettled. In looking at his basis for reassigning the cases that he received subsequent to that, spreading out the backlog is a perfect example of judicial efficiency, not knowing how other judges are going to rule. The fact that he has two state cases and the other judge in his jurisdiction does not is a perfect example of even if Judge Hines is going to rule in favor, he will have one state case to my two. And when the Army Court rules on the writ, the backlog will clear and we can address those cases in turn. Judge Johnson, in looking at the appellee's blind decision, the decision was not blind. Defense counsel had reached
I'm
out.
I'm sorry, the decision was what?
Was it not was not blind in terms of
blind.
His point.
Okay.
Blind, yes, Your Honor. In looking at the record, you'll see that defense counsel had reached out to ask Judge Pritchard about his detailing of cases long before notice of forum and pleas were offered by appellant, yet they decided not to ask any questions of Judge Hines. When they had him on the record, when he conducted that colloquy over a judge alone versus a panel selection of forum. So insofar as this issue didn't have an opportunity to be explored, the fact that Judge Pritchard didn't offer reasons didn't preclude defense counsel from asking Judge Hines about it on any occasion, whether it be his initial detailing to the case or on the eve of trial when they asked to be tried by him alone. And then, Judge Hardy, to your question, if I may, I see my time's about to expire, but with respect
Please,
to...
there was enough time for them to take an additional minute to respond to Judge Hardy.
Yes, Your Honor. So the trial judiciary, that's where this case, if Judge Pritchard had said, I can't touch this, it would have gone to the trial judiciary, as counsel for the appellee discussed. And this court could likely conclude that the trial judiciary would have looked at the only other Army judge in the Fifth Judicial Circuit, Judge Hines, as the logical next judge to take the case. So insofar as we get to Liljeburg, this court would need to find that Judge Hines was required to recuse himself and did not. Pending any additional questions from this court.
Seeing none, thank you, Captain Campbell. Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until 10:15 tomorrow morning at Hampton University.
All rise. Court is now adjourned. Judges will remain in place for the question and answer session.
Please be seated. So the court session is over. We're now going to move into a different phase where we invite any and all questions that you may have, except for we cannot discuss, will not discuss, this particular case. So you can ask generalized questions based on what you've seen today.